Okay, I kind of tricked you a little bit today because I said I was going to do a review on passages, and in a way I am, but I also am going to ask for a lot of reactions from you. Gail Sheehy's book, Predictable Crises of Adult Life, has been kind of a bestseller. In fact, it was for a while, now it's dropped down a little bit, but I probably wouldn't have picked it up and read it if I didn't have good cause to, and now I'm so glad I did. But let me tell you what, Gail starts out her book giving you a little bit of a story about where she is and how she got there. And I'm going to do that, even though I did a little of it last week when I talked about Seminex. But I think if you see where I am and what I'm doing and how I got there, you'll see why this book turned me on so much and why it helped to reinforce some things I was feeling. I grew up in a family, kind of middle-class Americans in St. Louis, Missouri, and I was the oldest of two children, two girls. I was almost an only child because I was 10 before my sister was born. And my parents were a very conservative Lutheran family. I had a lot of preachers in the background, although my father was not a preacher. I was an oldest daughter, which kind of pays off as you get into passages. What else? When I went through the first of the adult stages that are described in this book, the 18 to 22 bracket, I did what I was expected to do. I wanted to be a pastor, but you could hardly even say that then. And so I became a parochial school teacher, and I married a pastor, which was the next best thing to being one. And
next question.
And then went through the 20s, had three children, kept a neat house, did all the things there that I was supposed to do. There was a horrible year, though, from the time I was 29 to 30. I frequently said that the longest 10 years of my life were from the time I was 29 until the time I was 30. It seemed like 10 years, and it was really tough for a lot of different reasons. I had some physical illness, but I also had a kind of a depression going along with it, and it was a very bad time. About 3 years later, we were living in Minneapolis, and I had a recurrence of the physical illness, and it was, you know, it was a for real thing. I had a malignancy, and it was scary, and I faced death for the first time, you know, and said this could happen to me. I always thought that happened to old people, and so I went through another really trying time. In fact, I think I went through the what Gail Sheehy describes as the 35-year-old thing. I think I went through it 33 because of that crisis that pushed its way in and made some other things happen. And I think because I didn't go through a lot of the rebellion earlier between 18 and 22, I picked up a lot of those things later on. I had never questioned God or my parents or anything. You know, I just accepted everything. I did I was the person that my parents said I was to the nth degree. So then my youngest child went off to school when I was about 35, and I went back to teaching. I had been teaching earlier, and I was teaching again, and I enjoyed that. And eventually we moved back to St. Louis, and I continued teaching there. And then one day a friend, John Dom, the academic dean at Concordia Seminary, said, you know, I really would like for you to come to the seminary and be my administrative assistant. And I said, gee, yeah, that sounds like something different, you know, people that are that big instead of that big. And I really thought I'd like to try that. So I quit at the end of that school year and went to the seminary and did a variety of things, but all having to do with academic office. Then the exile took place, and I went to Seminex and became what you might call a full fledged administrator. They cooked up a title for me because they really didn't have one and called me coordinator because that meant that you did everything and anything that nobody else wanted to do. And so that's where I am now. But the last year has been kind of interesting too. As this thing has rolled along and the new church by the AELC came into being, the people started to say, gee, it's okay for a woman to be ordained. And I said, ha-ha, way back when, you know, I said I would really like to be ordained. But I'll tell you a secret, I didn't even have my bachelor's degree. And so along about December, I'd been taking courses all along at St. Louis University since Seminex had started, but I hadn't really decided to force the issue. And in December, I decided, yes, I was going to finish that thing this year, along with working 40 hours a week and doing all the other household kind of things that many women do. So Paul put up with me, and I slugged it through in the next two terms and finished that off this spring. At the end of that time, enrolled in the MAR program at Seminex this fall, but I do intend to continue working too, so I won't be finishing it off in a short time. I'll be taking it slow, especially in the beginning. I'll find out if I can do it. But Masters of Arts in Religion. Now, it's not the regular degree that leads to ordination. You would normally go into an MDiv program, a Master of Divinity, but I hope that because all of my early training, my first 3 years of college, were in parochial school, I'm kind of hoping to get through a colloquy program. Now, you know, all those things haven't been decided yet. I'm not sure how it's going to work. I really don't intend to have a parish. I want to continue working as an administrator. But I'd like to be able to celebrate, too. And I'd like to be able to proclaim the gospel, too. And it's just kind of, I can't believe it. But, and it may not happen. You know, I'll come back next year and tell you how far I am. But in the meantime, the assistant dean at the Metropolitan College at St. Louis University said, I'm going to write a book, she's going to write a book, on adult education. And she said, there's just so many things I want, and I want reaction of different people who have gone through adult crises recently. And she handed me this book and said, I'd like for you to read this. And this was maybe in March or April, and I said, Jen, I'm finishing these two courses and it's graduation at Seminex. I'll take it along to Holden Village with me and I'll read it while I'm there. And I have to be honest with you, I haven't quite finished it. But it's not speed reading either. And Paul was saying that Capon wasn't speed reading. I get so excited about it. You know, I start highlighting things and I go back to see if that checks with something she said earlier, and then I go on a couple more pages and I sit and think about it a while. And so it's been kind of actually slow reading. But what I want to do today is go through the mainly four stages of adult life, tell you what she says. I try and keep my opinions to myself, but I'm very poor at that. I'd like your reaction. Most of you, and all of you I guess, are over 18 and you're somewhere along life's way, and you can look back and say, no, that's ridiculous. That isn't true of, you know, or it certainly wasn't true for me. It might be true for someone else. And I'm going to have that all on tape. I'm going to take that back to St. Louis with me. And I hope that my friend there that's writing the book will benefit not just from my reactions to passages, but from yours too. Okay, so that's kind of why I'm doing it. And the first part of the book, if you read the book, tells why Gail Sheehy wrote the book. What made her decide to get this done? The main reason is that there hasn't been anything done on it. If you had little children, you knew there was Gazelle's book and Spock's book, and I read them all, you know, the terrible twos and the nifty nines, and I had to know what was going to happen next. But there isn't much written on adult stages. They just sort of say, well, okay, after you're 18, you just grow up. Well, as you know, some of the crises that you go through are worse than the terrible twos. And nobody warned you about it. You know, I remember coming home from the hospital after my first child was born, and my mother was there for a while, and that was really helpful. And then she turned around and left and went back to St. Louis, and we were in Indiana. And I started crying, and I couldn't stop crying, and everything that had seemed so beautiful about this birth. Paul told you the other day that the greatest day of my life was the day Michael was born. That was true, but now it was 3 weeks later and it was terrible. And I really cried, and I was sad and depressed, and I didn't know what was wrong. And finally somebody told me about the baby blues, and that's exactly what I had, but I didn't know it. You know, nobody had told me that that could happen. How could such a beautiful thing turn into such a bad thing so quickly? And after I found out that other people felt that way sometimes too, I said, oh, well, good. You know, I guess I can get this all together. And I washed the diapers and went on with things. But, and that's happened to me other times too. I mentioned before that when I was 29, I had such a miserable year. And I had an older neighbor across the street. She was really old, like 40. Now I'm a lot older than that. But I went and cried on her shoulder and told her how bad I was feeling. I didn't know what was wrong, you know. And she said, oh, when my three kids were preschoolers, I went through exactly the same thing. And she really pulled me through that time, just to know that somebody else had had a tough time. And what they had done, she said, you have to have something to do outside of your house. And I said, don't be ridiculous. We don't have any money, and my husband's gone all the time, and, you know, how can I do anything outside the house? There are these three babies. But she was a big bridge player, and she really tricked me into playing bridge. And she'd even help me get a babysitter once a week during the day, and Paul would babysit once a week at night. And so twice a week I got to go out and play bridge. And, you know, it almost became a religion for me. I started playing duplicate bridge, and I earned master points, and I thought the sun rose and set on a bridge table. And it got ridiculous. I finally got that all straightened out and found out the bridge is just a game that people play, and that it's not a way of life. And that, you know, but it did sort of pull me through another tough time of my life, and it was because a neighbor said that's what she did when she had a tough time, and it worked. Okay, now I'll shut up about me and talk about the book. First of all, just a couple general things before we start on the four stages. And I do want to stop at 5 o'clock so that at least if any of you want to leave at 5 for the early setting for dinner, please do so. You know, don't feel like you have to stay over if we're still going. A lot of people think of their lives. Now I'm really telling you what she says, okay. A lot of people think of their lives as a series of marker events, and they think that the marker events are what cause the crises in their life. But actually, the crises are all kind of there and are going to happen anyway. Sometimes a marker event can make it happen. Sometimes it can even make it happen a little bit better than it might without that event. But I think maybe you know what I mean. Well, I won't go into what me again, otherwise I would get all hung up on stories. Life is made up of internal feelings and external feelings, things that happen to you and things that are cooking inside of you. But very few people walk around and say, something's cooking inside of me, and I think it's going to do this. You know, they'll talk about the outside things way more than they talk about the inside things. In each passage of life, you have to give up some magic in order to grow up. You see that when you watch little kids, you know. Pretty soon they're not as excited about Santa Claus anymore. Well, they don't believe in him anymore, you know. So you got to give that up in order to be the next stage. And that continues on with adults. Now, there is another option. You can stop growing. You can find yourself a permanent home, sit there and be very comfortable, and never change very much. It's not really a good option, but it's a way to do it. I mentioned this earlier, but life's accidents can force some of the changes in your life. Human beings, thank God, have an individual inner dynamic that can never be precisely coded. So now from here on, we're going to try and do some coding. But because each person is a different person, it's going to be a little different for each one of you. And that's some of what we want to hear about today, too. Okay, first section. It's called Pulling Up Roots. Happens between 18 and 22. And what I'm going to do is just read the things that I highlighted as I went through the book. But you listen, if you hear one that really strikes a bell for you, that really sounds like, yeah, or that really sounds like, never, that's what I'd like to hear about. Okay. We find during this time, 18 to 22, that we like to find beliefs that we can call our own. We're drawn to fads that are inaccessible to our parents. We cover our fears with acts of defiance. We sometimes need to rebound to our family. Gail Sheehy says, you must have an identity crisis during this time, because this is when you're first searching for your identity. This is when you're first trying to find out, who am I? You know, am I just the person that my parents said I was? Or who am I? We have to search for a balance between satisfaction and discontent. We learn about trusting between two folks. Two strong pulls during that time are a merger self and a seeker self. Merger self is trying to find somebody to be really good friends with, man or woman. And the seeker self is trying to go out and say, these are new things I'm looking for. And we have to learn to begin to break away from our inner custodian, but not too fast and not too far. The inner custodian is that little something that your parents built into you that tells you the difference between right and wrong, but also tells you a lot of other things. I am going to be tempted to tell you one more story. When Michael was a little bitty guy, we told him that about stoplights, and one day he looked at a stoplight that was yellow, and he said, that means don't fall down. And I said, don't fall down? Why in the world would that mean don't fall down? And then I remembered that we had said, red means stop, and green means go, and yellow means be careful. And the only other time I used be careful would be careful, don't fall down. And so I had built into him the feeling that a yellow light meant don't fall down. And we have a lot of things built into us, some a lot more than others, and some much stronger than others, but you all have an inner custodian that kind of takes care of the works in there. And you have to learn which parts of that you can pull away from and which parts you dare not. You need to not go too far or too fast or you're going to be in trouble. But you are moving from the family to the world. If you decide to head off every crisis, you will inhibit your development. Another funny thing that happens is that frequently mom and dad's midlife crisis is happening at the same time that the 18 to 22 year olds are going through theirs. Isn't that right, Michael? Isn't that right, Mary Jo? So, you know, our kids are that age when we reach that midlife stage, so you're both going through a crisis at the same time. It's not good to let everybody else define who you are and you not have anything to say about it. Tumult is essential. If you're not going to have any tumult, then you're going to have to become just what somebody else says you are. During the 50s, one of the things that was used by 18 to 20 year olds was drinking and hot rodding. That was typical of the 50s. During the 60s, causes, the war in Vietnam, all those things. During the 70s, it seems to be an apathetic aftermath, but the 70s aren't over yet, and so it kind of remains to be seen what the reaction of the 70s is on this age group. You have to be careful not to leap to a negative identity. Otherwise, you might become just the opposite of what you should be. It's a period of transition. Most women until recently didn't have as strong a crisis during this time, didn't pull loose as much, or piggybacked on a stronger person. And you know, the person like Paul was that's who I was going with at that time too. You know, he was going through a lot of crises. I really didn't. Now, I kind of just rode along with him and didn't solve all my problems for me by any means. But he was considered the strong one. Firstborn daughters were frequently better off because they were told that they were stronger people. Jailbreak marriages, a way to get out of the trap of the family if you can't handle it on your own. Other kinds of openings, a way out, traveling around, bumming around the country, living in communes, other solutions to getting out, besides jailbreak marriages. The idea that you have to find somebody to complete yourself, that you can't get an identity unless you find someone to complete that identity for you. Women have stronger feelings to merge during that time. Later on, men have stronger feelings to merge. College women usually had to choose between merge or seek. Let's see. One part of the individual is seeking freedom. This is a neat one. One part is seeking freedom, and the other part is seeking someone to surrender their freedom to. So it's the seeker and the merger again going on. Both of those things are happening. The beginning of couples' relationships. Now, I think I'm going to stop with that. That's kind of what I picked out of that first section, and maybe we can talk about that, but I'm almost going to hold a limit on it so that we can get into each of the others. Did you hear anything in that section that you could really agree with or disagree with, or that you were lukewarm on? Have any feelings that you remember from that period that were not in that list?
I was just going to say that I can see myself in everything that you just read. Even if I'm going to be all I have been
to. Score one.
Put it on the tape.
The tumult, what's in your definition of tumult? Is that really like a tumultuous type time? I don't recognize a time in that period of my life that was really, you know, torn mm-hmm. or anything like that. I never recall being really, you know, ripped up over it at the end of the year.
Okay, now Gail Sheehy says it has to happen then or it's going to happen later. Happy days. I'm not saying I agree with that. In fact, I told you that I went through none then, although I really do feel like some of my others were a little more severe. Because of the fact that I didn't have eyes. Those were the best years of my life. You know, I just walked around smiling all the time. It was really, and Paul kept saying, oh, it's terrible, you know. And he really had a rough later teen years. And I kept saying, what's wrong with you? You know, everything's taken care of. My parents are paying my college tuition. I met you. You met me. What more could you ask for, you know? And he's trying to find out who he is, and I was just covering up who I was.
But it's like, you know, it can't happen a little bit of time. I'm not saying that, you know, I feel like I have my identity together and everything, but I feel like it was, you know, a thorn or two at a time, you know, a few slivers every once in a while and not any, big crisis, you know, right out there in the open.
Somebody else want to
agree? That's the place where I'd agree. I'm with you. I don't think it has to be tumultuous, is that the word?
Mm-hmm.
I think some people smooth through that one. What nobody knows is why. Why some people can make that transition very smoothly and why others have to do it with all those lumpy looking red spots.
Unless I repressed all that, but that all went pretty well.
Do you suppose some parents do a better job of helping kids to be themselves and not belittle me's. For them it might go a little easier.
That's a nice theory. It remains to be demonstrated. It's believed,
yeah.
Widely believed.
I don't think that happened necessarily for me. I was in a constant battle of be different than my mother. You know, that was the big thing. She was always trying to make me like herself. And maybe I had early practice at being myself because, you know, I began right from a tomboy stage, you know, to rebel against, you know, hating pink because she liked it and liking to climb trees in spite of her and, you know, that kind of thing. So, you know, maybe it started earlier and maybe I was more prepared, you know, for that.
And maybe there's a clue as to how to make the 18 to 20 transition easier, huh? Start early and do a lot of push-ups.
I think that transition can be affected also by the surroundings that you choose. Like, I went to a church school, which, you know, continued to give me the family kind of support as far as religion and stuff. I wasn't hit nearly as hard by so many questions at once as my sister was, who went to university. And she had a lot more bumps when she was 18 to 22 than I did. You know, and I think that that partly made the difference.
I don't know about that. I went to a church, college, and everything. Was it crazy?
Okay.
Didn't have anything to do with, you know, which questions were there?
Well, yeah, but the questions were there, but there was also the same idealism or something or other that I experienced in my family that I wouldn't have found at a university, as an underlying water of support. You know, I mean, I would have splashed a lot, and I did splash a lot, but I didn't ever go under completely.
Okay, just because of the press of time, I think I'm going to stop there and go on to the trying 20s. This is the next passage that Gail Sheehy describes. It's longer and more stable. Listen to these as descriptions. It's a time when you're working out the externals, shaping a dream, preparing for your life work. Begin to have a capacity for intimacy. But the big word in the 20s seems to be should. The shoulds that your family have related to you, the shoulds of your culture, and the shoulds of your peers. But an important thing to remember is that the 20s are not irrevocable. It's the time to take hold of the adult world, mastering things. Find a mentor. That's kind of interesting. I don't think I even knew what mentor meant when I was 20. And I think it was just maybe 8 or so years ago that I looked for that kind of thing outside of laying it on my husband. Explore and experiment versus building safe places. Any suggestion that's made to us that we are like our parents raises our hackles, but it's probably true. And then the relationships in couples during that time tend to stabilize. They must remember that their growing in tandem is not possible. Two people can't grow exactly the same all the time. It has to be a different rate of growth. And continuing bliss is not possible. And rational efforts by the couple frequently thinks that if they put rational efforts into it, they can accomplish anything in their married life, and that isn't possible. If these people have children, they may take on the form of a phantom parent. They may begin to act just exactly as their parents did. There's kind of a seesaw at work in the relationship. The husband is down and the wife's up, and the wife's down and the husband's up. We knew a couple like that's still always going on. One of them is always sick, and not just a little bit sick, just terribly sick, and it's a real thing that's going on all the time. In part of her survey, she asked men the reasons why they married, and these were men who had married during their 20s, and these are the reasons they gave. I thought I should. It was what was expected of me. I needed someone to take care of me, someone to fill a vacancy in my life. I needed to get away from the situation that I was in, or I married for prestige or practical purposes. Gail Sheehy says that not one of the men said they married because of love. I asked my husband without telling him the answers, and he said he married me because he loved me. And I don't know if he read the book I had. Some facts about women at that time. And a woman in the 20s doesn't have to find or doesn't feel driven to find an independent form. She does have some fear of success, and she also thinks that a mate might complete her. Then, right at that point, I'm going to go on with this little bit before we start with Catch 30, but there's a little sneak preview then given in the book that I said, well, why in the world they do that there? Because it really talks about older and younger and in between, but I guess she didn't know where else to put it in, so she put it in here. She calls it a sneak preview. She said, for men, there's often a yo-yo thing going on in their life. There's a tug between job and the relationship with his woman. Which is the most important? Which way is he going to go today? And one of the strongest categories for women is the caregiver, and the kind of yo-yo thing that goes on in her life is that she might love being a housewife, but she wants to be sure that she's cherished all the time for this, and if that changes at all, then she has some tugs going on the other way. Just a couple other things that were mentioned in that section is that there are fewer mentors for women, and I found that interesting because I decided maybe that's why I didn't know what it meant. And that little section then ended with this statement that I liked. Life does not end. Time is short. Life, oh my goodness, get this right. Life does end. Okay, right, we know that. Time is short. Each of us travels alone. No one else can always keep us safe. And there are some parts of our personalities that we cannot change or ignore, even if eventually we are to find if we are eventually to find unity within ourselves. I guess I thought there was something to be said about that, that it's, you think of your close friends or the people that you're married to and you think you need these things, but it comes right down to it. You are a separate entity in yourself. And other than needing God, you got to learn how to handle some of these problems. Oh, here it is. Okay, let's go over some of these trying 20s things. Is there anybody that's in the trying 20s right now and heard some of these? This working out external shape, a dream, prepare for life, work capacity for intimacy, shoulds. Did some of those ring bells or did they sound like what's not going on at that age?
Seems like she's really concentrating on the couples there. I mean, assuming that in the 20s.
I did take one section out and say that this was about couples, and it's true then toward the end it kind of slips into couples again, but I think the first part would be true of men or women. Now, maybe I'm wrong. Working out the externals, shaping a dream, prepare for your life work, capacity for intimacy, the shoulds, mastering what you're supposed to be.
The section in there of what she said for women in the 20s, would you go over that fast? There's something about independence and...
Yeah, it said a woman doesn't have to find an independent form in the 20s.
I radically disagree with that. I mean, as far as myself.
Mm-hmm.
That's my big thing.
Yeah.
But I don't know, that might depend on a marriage,
I couldn't probably find it right now if I went to look it up, but I think as I look back on it that maybe what she was saying is that it's not as necessary. If you look at all women and all men, then men really have to find an independent form for that during the 20s, and maybe for women that wouldn't be quite as necessary. Now, I still see where you might object to it, but I think it might have come out of that kind of a setting. Maybe I check it later and let you know.
For some women, it would be every bit as necessary as it would for most men.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Does she mention anything about the fear of like being a failure? Is that undershoot? I know I have a lot of friends when we get together and we talk about, maybe the fear of not becoming whatever we're trying to become in our life.
There was that thing of fear of success.
Yeah, fear of success, but that's almost the opposite.
Yeah,
that's for women, though.
Yeah, and that was for women, right.
Yeah, I disagree
with that. More a general thing of what Verlana is saying for men and women, fear of failure, not succeeding in all these other empty-on things.
Would that come under shoulds? Like you should be something and fear that you might not?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I guess it could.
One of the shoulds is you should be a success. Isn't that right, Marla?
Does seem to come as a should.
Mm-hmm. Might be somewhat helpful in trying to analyze what's going on here to get a word of the methodology. Is this the result of a survey or just her insights into her family and her personal life? Or
no. She surveyed 151 middle class Americans. She had to keep it somewhat, you know, in order to make it a fair sample, she had to keep it somewhat in one country and with one kind of bracket. They varied in age from 18 to 50, with the most of them in the middle. And as you read the book, she uses a lot of the case histories, and some of them are very interesting. You feel like you're peeking in somebody's bedroom or something, you know. But I didn't use any of that in the review because usually it was just to prove some of these other factors. So that's where it comes from.
The peeking in the bedroom is what makes it a bestseller. Any of you fledgling authors out there.
I got a question about mentors. Where does she say you're supposed to find these things? These mentors, so what is it?
Okay, I think a mentor is like, you used to always talk about finding a father confessor.
Yeah.
Isn't that a mentor?
Yeah,
yeah.
Exactly.
Okay, I didn't stop and ask you that, but I remember that all the while we were first married, you'd say, oh, if we could just spend a little more time in this city, that man could be my father confessor. And it's usually a person who's maybe 12 or so years older. Wouldn't have to be, have to be older, I think. It would have to be older. And that person would be somebody that you really admire and respect and who would want to listen to what you have to say. And probably appreciate you. If what he did was critical, you wouldn't go back, right?
You might go back a few times.
Yeah.
A strong role model that you can imitate, and a person who would foster you, support you.
I was in a workshop last fall where they asked us to list models that we had had, and I found that really difficult. And you know, I hate to keep talking about John Donne, but I finally decided that he had come as close as anything to a model for me. And I think there aren't many women models available in what I wanted to do. And then if that model is someone that you can talk to, sometimes a model for a teenager might be a movie star or a singer or something. But that wouldn't be a mentor. The mentor has to be somebody who's close enough to listen to you and be interested in you.
Well, could the mentor life be different? So like a mentor for a man, could it be a woman, or for a woman,
mm-hmm.
could it be a man?
Mm-hmm. It sure could. More likely not, but it sure could. Isn't that right?
Yes,
okay.
I would agree. As an example of that, Seminex has just a few women students. You know some of them, Roland. I think some of those women have selected some faculty people who are functioning as a mentor for them. Would you agree? And that's a woman selecting a man mentor, but it's largely a male profession.
Is the mentor relationship, is that sort of more like a long-term relationship?
Well, it sometimes changes. As we get into one of these other ones, it said, a young man who, you know, maybe 22 years old, who picked an older man, the president of the company, as his mentor, and then eventually wanted to take over his job. You know, by the time he got to be 40 and the boss got to be 55 or whatever, then he wasn't his mentor anymore because he was trying to sneak into his job position, and so that had fallen apart over time. And there's usually a break with that mentor later on. It might last 10 or 15 years, but it wouldn't go on forever. And it wouldn't be a roommate. You know, it wouldn't be a peer. It wouldn't really be a mentor.
Mentors?
No, I don't think everybody always does, but I think it's a good idea. I think.
But I can't identify anyone that fits into that.
Yeah.
I'm not in my 20s yet.
I think it's
been moving around so fast. That's why I wondered about the
Yeah, right. You're going to have a portable mentor. shouldn't carry around with you. That does become a problem if you're not in one spot. Frequently is someone that's related to the job that you're so interested in when you're 20. You know, and then the mentor understands that job. If you want to be a writer for a newspaper, and one of the big deal people on the newspaper staff helps you along the way, that person will become your mentor. That's what Gail Sheehy says, and I, okay.
I wonder how many people in the room could pick up someone who would...
Yeah, that's interesting.
I can think of a lady right now that's about 15 years older than I do. We're just like best friends, and she writes to me constantly. When we get together, I feel like I can tell her anything.
Yeah. She's your mentor.
I'm a godmother for the child, and she feels like she told me once, I hope that my daughter can talk to you like you can talk to me. You know, and we're just so close, and I can really relate to that.
Yeah. And frequently the daughter can't talk to the mother that way, you know, so that's a very interesting thing. Some of you know Mary Jo, my daughter, who's been here all winter, and yesterday I was talking to Nancy Winter, and I decided that Nancy was Mary Jo's mentor. There was no doubt about it. She talked to Nancy during the winter time.
I wonder about the age difference, though. If you can't maybe admire someone who is a peer in you so much that you can place them up to that level, if they do seem more mature than you are.
Well, it's interesting. I think it'd be difficult. Let's go through with that. You mind if I just backtrack one question and say, how many of you remember having a mentor, someone that you could talk to that wasn't your parent? I did. Not when I was 20, but later on. Yeah.
Is it just somebody that you can talk to, or somebody that's a role model?
It's
there again.
I think it's a little bit of a talk to is awfully important, and then if it's role model, I think that completes the picture. Might
probably,
be one
mentor would probably have to include sort of both, right?
I would think so. Wouldn't necessarily have to be a professional role model. It could be a personal role model.
I think I've been experiencing a personal role model lately, but strangely enough, it's the other way around. She's about 15 years younger than I am. And
that's one of the advantages.
But in her personal life, her life with the Lord and so forth, she really is serving as a mentor to me at this time.
Well, one of the advantages of not being in 20 to 30 anymore is you can pick it. You can do your picking of a role model or a mentor in a different direction.
So I'm not odd.
How many through their 20s don't remember ever in the 20s having a mentor?
Okay, in the 20s I didn't. I'll raise my hand for both, because in the 20s I didn't. It was later.
Did not.
I did not.
Well, you were sure looking for one.
I sure was. No problem. Couldn't find one good enough.
So, just for my take purpose, there were more that said that they did have one somewhere along the line than responded to that last. But there certainly were 5 or 6 or 7 that said they had not had one. Yes?
I feel that you have them all through life. I can remember one specifically from 7th grade, again in high school period, several in college. I still have some.
I think it's helpful. I think it might be more necessary right in the 20s, but it certainly is helpful throughout. I'm going to hurry on now. We're really getting close here. The next section is called Catch 30. You remember the movie Catch 22. Well, this is Catch 30. You become impatient with the shoulds. Very frequently, tear up the life that we build all through the 20s. If you're married, you feel discontent. The voices from within become more consistent. You begin to think of me instead of others. Now, this next little group is just on couples, all right? This is the spot where most marriages are likely to break, right around 30. There are other times, too, but this is the high spot. Husband frequently says to his wife, you should be something more than you are. If there's a divorce, sometimes after the divorce, either the man or the woman, but more likely the woman, will really shape up. And still, that isn't meant that a divorce is a cure-all. It isn't. It's just her way of rebounding after the divorce, or possibly the man's way of rebounding, to say, look, the world hasn't come to an end. see, I can lose weight and put color stuff on my hair. I guess to me that doesn't all happen at 30. But anyway, that's part of it. Then there's kind of a rooting period that goes on, too. Those were some of the tearing apart things. Accomplishments are expected of us, and it's very healthy to set down roots. You begin to think, I should now stay in a place for a while. Settling down, buying a home, beginning to climb the career ladder. Another response on the couple's end of things is that they might decide to stay in their marriage but take more elastic positions, not be as tight together as they were for a while, but to say, well, okay, we can make it if I let you do this and if you let me do that. The single person, frequently that person's boss becomes the central figure in their life. They might lavish attention on nephews and nieces. One single woman, I just really like this one, said, I'm going to be on the cover of Time, but I'm also going to have four children later on. And it's nice to think that you can work that all out, and maybe you can, but sometimes it doesn't work out quite that way. Catch 30 requires a personal solution. Okay, here this is another important statement. One part of the solution remains constant for everyone, and that's the willingness to allow change. But then the first part of that was Catch 30 requires a personal solution. Again, each person is a person and has to have their own solution to the move into the 30s. You can't say, okay, now everybody that's 30 should do this, this, and this, and you'll be fine. That won't work. Okay. Okay, this is another little stuck-in-between section that's called, But I'm Unique. You know, all those things are fine for everybody else, but I'm different. And so what she did was to list the men's patterns and the women's patterns. And I'm just going to read off the men's and women's and see if you agree with those. These are not just for Catch 30. This, again, is a little farther, you know, kind of spread over the next years. Men's patterns. Three patterns emerged as the most prevalent among the men interviewed. The transients, who were unwilling or unable to make any firm commitment in their 20s, and they prolonged the experiments of their youth. Now, that kind of did deal with 20s again and 30s, but some of these don't. Men's patterns again. Locked in. They make solid commitments in their 20s, but without much crisis or much self-examination, and they don't change much for the rest of their life. The Wunderkind. They create risks and play to win, often believing that once they reach the top, their personal insecurities will vanish. And sometimes those people make it, and sometimes they don't. And then there are three other patterns that are less common, the never married man. Since only 5% of American men over 40 are unmarried, it's difficult to make a valid statement about so small a group. But she does kind of divide them into two parts. The para-nurturers, they elect by their occupational commitment to care for the family of man, like a clergyman might or a medical missionary. Or they devote the kind of nurturing to a friend that's customarily provided by wives. Latency boys, they avoid the process of adolescence altogether and remain bound to their mothers throughout their adult years. I'm sure you know a couple of those, but there aren't many, thank heavens. And then the integrator is a male integrator who tries to do everything. He wants, you know, to have a family. He wants to, he works toward economic comfort. He wants to be beneficial to his society. He just wants everything that's possible. And sometimes you can do everything and sometimes you can't. And that men are more likely to be able to pull off that integrator role than the women are. Because for a woman to say, okay, I want a career and I'm going to raise children and all these things, it sometimes gets to be too much. At least the people that she interviewed, that seemed to be a problem. Now the women, where did they go? This is in that section, But I'm Unique. The woman might be a caregiver, And that can be a very good thing, or it can be carried to the extreme, as is frequently described in the total woman, you know, where you think, I don't believe this. Then there's the either-or situation for a woman, who she could either be a nurturer who defers achievement, or an achiever who defers nurturing. And then there's another section for women called the late baby superachiever, and that was mostly an interview with Margaret Mead, who had one child when she was about 38, I think. And but she was just such a super achiever that, you know, I'd say your chances for really making that work are not so great. The integrators among women attempt to do it all, and it said that if they're doing it all at one time, they're probably going to run into trouble. And the never married woman, our society is stingy about acknowledging this as a legitimate pattern, but it is. And the transients, and they're prolonged wandering without commitments. You know, it's okay when you're 21 or 22, whatever you are, and you say, I don't stay in one place long enough. But if you move into your 30s and 40s and you're still just wandering around from place to place and you've never really made a commitment, that's a strange place to be. Okay, now I have rattled a lot, but that was catch 30 with the transition section on But I'm Unique, and the next section is the deadline decade, 35 to 45. let's react to this one a little bit. I'm sure there are people who are right around catch 30 and have some opinions on, is this a time when you become impatient with all those shoulds of the 20s? Are you changing the lifestyle that you built in the 20s? If you're married, do you feel discontent? What else? I need to go over them all again. I have some people that remember the 30s. We don't have anything.
I know it was the worst year I ever had a birthday.
When you were 30.
I think it. A lot of what you said sure fits me. I lucked out. When I was 33, I left the parish and went off to graduate school, fortunately with a nice, comfortable scholarship. If that hadn't happened to me, I was increasingly dissatisfied with what I was doing and probably would have found something else to do. A real kind of change of direction.
Yes, I think I can impact that too, and I think I always hesitate to say too much positive about marriage personally, because every time my wife and I feel we have a very happy marriage, I hesitate to say it because I've heard a lot of people say they had a happy marriage and then the next 2 or 3 years, you know,
to knock on wood.
But I don't think we experienced much of that dissatisfaction in the 30s, but I'm wondering whether a variable in that is those of us who stretch education out almost until Social Security, that serves as a way of cutting through some of those generational gaps there.
It's a way to legitimately solve the problem, huh? At least until somebody catches us.
Keep going with it. I mean, that gives, in a sense, I had some different peers because I was still in school, I mean, off and on until last year. And so I feel at different ages, at different stages. I mean, at the same stage, I have different age relationships, which I think felt kind of good so far.
Right.
I'm thinking, for me, some of this, the part about the shoulds fading, I think that began to happen strongly to me. I was not feeling the compulsion to succeed.
Okay, I'll go on, and I'm going to go ahead and finish this thing, but if anyone wants to make that 5 o'clock early setting, you're welcome to leave. I can't possibly get it finished in the next 1 minute, so I'll just go ahead.
One more comment there.
Sure.
The temper of the times of that period, when you're going through the 20s or the 30s, has a very strong impact on how you're going to handle yourself.
Mm-hmm.
For example, some of these things happened during World War II, when I was in the military, you see. And that certainly
right, you
modified,
have a whole lot of choice.
Modified my behavior yeah, right. in so many ways. And so the 60s, too,
right.
affected those who were in their 20s and in their 30s and in their 40s because their kids were impacted by the 60s.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's an ingredient which would have to be reckoned with very carefully.
Right.
And those external things.
I'm glad you brought that out. That's not, she doesn't mention that very often. In one point with the pulling up roots, 18 to 22, she mentions that there were different reactions according to whether you were at that stage in the 50s, 60s, or 70s. But that's about the only time she says that.
I think that goes with Becky's comment, too, about women having,
independent form. Because mm-hmm. that's changed just and continues to change.
And that's what I was trying to say, too, depending on your external circumstances.
The college,
you know, mm-hmm. yeah. Well, when I was mentioning the college mm-hmm. background, well, maybe it's not just the college background, but that's the external things that were happening to you. Makes a lot of difference. Mm-hmm. What's happening inside?
But isn't a... what do you think? Is it the same thing going on inside that just happens to take different external form because of the circumstances of the times? I could imagine some, if World War II had come along when I was 33, instead of going to graduate school, I'd probably have gone to the military. What was going on inside of me was some of the shoulds were beginning to fail and didn't need them anymore, didn't need to do all that stuff. My options would have been different.
Well, I'm talking about war. That's why so many people enjoy war.
Gives them
such a good time as during the war period. You know, prosperity, adventure, travel, the whole bit. You know, that positive side which glamorizes the demonic.
Agreed.
The external forces that play in your life during that period of time do a tremendous amount as far as which direction you're going. You said something about a three of a woman achieving more or wanting to achieve more with their life in that period of time, going more individualistic.
Mm-hmm.
I was forced into it, and I really don't know whether it would have happened if my husband had lived. I don't know if it would have happened or if he hadn't lived.
Mm-hmm. Yes, but again, circumstances.
So the circumstances were what made me do what I did.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But the shoulds I can see.
Mm-hmm.
The shoulds. All the things that have become previously to that. You should do this choice, you should do that, you should do this. They kind of disappeared because nobody could live my life for me. I had to do what I had to do,
mm-hmm.
whether it was right in their eyes or not.
Right. Okay, that's good.
I kind of related that kind of an idea to what she was saying up here. She was saying that she felt that she was comfortable being single in the 20s and that this was the thing she wanted to be doing. Yeah, but if the right man came along, it might be a whole different story. And one can't put finding the right man into a slot and say, I'm going to have finding the right man happen at age 30 or 28 or 35 or 22. You know, it does happen when it happens.
It may never happen.
Yeah, it may never happen.
Well, and I think what we used to do is we kind of so expected it to happen during the early 20s that you made it happen. You found a right man. I mean, why is it so different now, you know? And so I think that, you know, you said, I should get married. There must be a man for me. Okay. And and I think now... No, I really didn't mean that. But I think now we say that isn't such a strong thing anymore. And so that must be why it's changing. It isn't that people have changed. It's that what we're saying is acceptable or okay or what the shoulds are.
It almost sounds like you go through another period of rebellion then in your 30s. Just like in your teens, if you're disregarding all your shoulds, and like how you say the fourth, if it's most likely they're higher. Sounds like it's going just like through your teens again.
Well, she says there are four crises in adult life. And the one is the 18 to 22, happens sometime in there. That's a very strong, and she gives them different kind of degrees. Another one happens at the beginning of the 20s, the trying 20s. Then the beginning of the 30s, and then sometime between 35 and 45. And after that, she says everything's beautiful. So if you make it to 45, you have a full-out authenticity crisis. You say, probably stronger than you ever have before, who's the real me? Women have this somewhat earlier than men, generally, but sometime during that time. And the assertiveness of women starts to come out a little bit more during that time period, too, between 35 and 45. Men feel like it's the last chance to pull away from the pack. Or another strong feeling of the men is that they become stale, restless, burdened, unappreciated. You look at this period in your life as kind of a meridian. You say, okay, I'm halfway through. I wonder what's going to be on the other side. And so you start to survey the other side. You say, there's only so much more time. And usually built into that is some apprehension about death and dying. And when I went through that little blurb before on who I am, I said, I think that happened to me about 33 because I was really sick. And it panicked me. It was almost worse than the sickness, was the fear that I was going to die. And I had never thought about my own personal death. So sometime there. And then an interesting question to ask yourself, if you're between 35 and 40 or beyond, when was the first time that you began to feel old? And she did that with all the people above that age then. And I said, gee, when was the first time I began to feel old? I felt old last week when I tried to walk to Heart Lake, but it was before that, I know. But think about that. When was the first time? Have a recollection of that? Maybe I just stop here for a minute while we're...
When I was 24.
Really?
Your birthday?
Huh?
On your birthday?
No, before my
25th. I don't know about feeling old, but I can remember consciously feeling that all of a sudden I was reaching a point where I could make major life decisions, like choosing to leave a pattern that I was traveling in, that I had the freedom to choose to do something totally different, to adopt a different kind of lifestyle, to become a different sort of person than I had been kind of programmed almost to be. I can remember feeling conscious.
I think that's part of defining who you are and saying, yeah, okay, somebody else has been saying this is who I am, and now I think I'm going to look at myself.
Yeah, that's not,
it's not so much old age. Old age is more, what?
You can't keep up with youth.
Who said? I didn't hear.
I said, when you can't keep up with the youth, you start to feel this.
You feel like you can't walk as fast. I think when Paul begins to lose the wrestling matches with his sons, when he'd been winning them for years, and then suddenly can't win them anymore, I would guess that sometimes you say, gee, what happened? You know, I used to always be able to pin him down.
Because I'm getting old, because he's grown up.
Oh, I think for me it's when I'm pleased that some young person is enjoying my company.
Well, that's a good feeling. You also realize that you're old.
But yeah, but I'm sensing, perceiving myself as getting old.
Okay.
At moments.
I guess for some people, it's when you look in the mirror and see some wrinkles that you didn't see before, or maybe Paul.
Mine was when I went to a doctor with a problem with my foot, and he said, "You'll have to learn to live with it." I've always been able to get well.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Okay, that's a good one. That is a good one.
You mentioned something about arthritis.
Now only old people have What was that little blurb we read in the paper? It said, I'm not as old as my mother was when she was 45, and I can prove it because I wear blue jeans, and my mother didn't wear blue jeans, and I do this, and I do that. And then it listed some of the things that are the same, like I can't see as well at a distance anymore. And, you know, I get an ache and a pain, and it doesn't just go away. 3 days before Christmas a year ago, my knee started hurting, and it's been hurting ever since, and I can't believe it. Every day I think it's going to stop today, and it hasn't. That knee still hurts. And, yeah, I think those are some.
I think also if you're raising a family, it's when your family leaves. When the whole, you know, when the last one leaves the nest.
The first
and you start getting the aches and the pains and all the other things come along about the same time.
When you bump into a friend of yours who's a grandma.
Good one.
Okay, back to a high school reunion.
Oh boy.
It's nothing but old
people.
They
all look older than I did.
Right. Recognize anybody? And the funny thing is, they don't recognize you. That was quite
sure. That's a good one. Mm-hmm. High school reunion.
So young.
And I've bumped into some people here. Where are you? That we went to LBI together over 30 years ago. So, and she recognized me. I was sitting next to her at your session yesterday afternoon, and she recognized my voice.
Okay.
And my face was on. Physical age. I mean, you're feeling old mentally and feeling old physically. I think there might be a difference there too.
Yeah, and I guess
part of staying young is feeling young mentally despite your body's age.
Yeah.
But I think, you know, part of feeling old is feeling old mentally despite the fact that your body looks and feels still young. Because when I was talking about feeling old, I was feeling old mentally, you know, being mad at
that's what Lori was
skateboarding on their hands down the nose. That was my kid.
That's a good one, I think. I like that. That's
each individual, I think, allows themselves to become old mentally or not old. It's a choice they can make.
I think I had the advantage you had, only mine happened later. My family allowed me to go back to school and finish my college work, and I was about 43, about 10 years older than you. And being thrown into that milieu of young people and at least young thinking, there were a lot of people around my age there, kept me younger. I was more prepared and able and ready, willing to try to cope with the stresses and strains that my kids have been trying to cope with in finding their own identity and sorting out whether they do or don't go along with the new morality kind of thing, this sort of thing, then I think that I would have been if I had not been exposed to the college scene just prior to their going through the college scene themselves.
Okay. Other feelings in this deadline decade, a search for authenticity. I haven't said that one before, but that's the biggie. Death strikes harder. It seems like you hear about more people that are dying. Business psychology shrinks our work span, while in truth of the matter is medical science has increased our work span. You're kind of in a state of suspended animation. It's a transition that's as critical as adolescence. There's one little thing here out of The Velveteen Rabbit that I read to Paul last night, and I'd like to read to you now. Velveteen Rabbit is a children's book. One day, just to set you up for this, one day the young rabbit asked the skin horse, who has been around the nursery quite some time, what is real and does it hurt? Sometimes, said the skin horse, for he was always very truthful, when you're real, you don't mind being hurt. Does it happen all at once, like being wound up, he asked, or bit by bit? It doesn't happen all at once, said the skin horse. You become. It takes a long time. That's why it doesn't often happen to people who break easily, or have sharp edges, or who have to be carefully kept. Generally, by the time you're real, most of your hair has been loved off, and your eyes drop out, and you get loose in the joints, and you're very shabby. But these things don't matter at all, because once you're real, you can't be ugly, except to people who don't understand. I thought that might make you feel a little bit better about having your joints not working. Let's see. The only way to handle all this disassembling is to go into the darkness and explore it. He says, don't wait till you're 50. Do it earlier than that. The theme for midlife should be let go. Don't hang on to everything. Be willing to change. For each of us, there is an opportunity to emerge in a reborn person. After all, you're in good company. Dante wrote the same kind of things in 1301. There are spiritual crises during this time, too. They're saying in this book, because they're not talking to a good group of Lutherans always, that it's more difficult to find comfort than Dante could in the 14th century by seeking it out in religion. Now, most of us still can find some comfort through that. He says, be careful not to confuse the words middle age and midlife. Everybody in this room, I believe, is in midlife. What depends? She says you have to be 18 to be in midlife, but middle age is something that happens around 40 or 50. So at least that's the terminology that she uses. Then they go through some little blurby things again. I'll just rattle these off. At 35, usually if you're a woman, your last child goes off to school if you're married. You might re-enter the working world. If you were divorced at catch 30, you might get a second husband. This is also an age where there are runaway wives. And the biological boundaries are brought into sight for a woman. You reach 35 and you say, yeah, probably can't have any more children, or at least I shouldn't have any more. And I read something yesterday about my sister. I decided it was about my sister. She had two children, and her youngest was ready to go away to school this year, and she's 35. And, well, now she's 37. This happened 2 years ago. And she got pregnant and had twins. And she just moaned and groaned. This was the worst thing in the world that could have happened to her. And after I read this book, I decided that really it wasn't such a big mistake. Because when your youngest child goes off to school, you have to really make some big decisions. Usually a woman decides to either go back to school or go back to work or somehow regroups her life at that point. But another thing to do is to have another child. Then you continue, you know, you just get another 5 years to be a caregiver. Again, that's something you understand. Now, being a caregiver isn't all bad, but it's easier to do something that you've done and that you know how to do than to say, well, what am I going to do now? And she frequently looks to me, I'm quite a bit older than she is, but she'll say, gee, you know, I'll never be able to pull off what you did, and I think, aha. And then she had those twins, and that was such a big mistake, but it wasn't a mistake at all. I have to tell her that. She'll probably hit me with a book. She still says it was a mistake. No,
she didn't
now they're two. All right, so then they say, after this is over, at least this is what the book says, when you get to 45, there's a section called renewal, or if there's no renewal, then at least resignation. Your equilibrium is regained. If you refuse to budge during 35 to 45, the staleness will calcify, and you probably would go through a long period then of resignation, which at least would feel comfortable, even though it wouldn't be as good as if you had confronted yourself during the middle years and found a renewal of purpose. And I believe most people do to some degree or another. These may be the best years of your life. After age 45, friends become very important, and so does privacy. And something that's happened to us is that we found out how really important we are to each other, and we spend a lot of time out in the country with just the two of us instead of the whole family, and it's been neat. And today we went on a hike and we said, gee, this is one of the best hikes we took, and it was just the two of us, and we had a little lunch packed in our pack. And so, you know, nothing bad about the kids, I love them, but you can have all kinds of other things go on after that. And if you're not married after age 45, friends can take that place. They can become a very important part of your life. I want to read 1.5 paragraphs to you, and then I'll stop and we'll react to this whole last part and call it a day. It would be surprising if we didn't experience some pain as we leave the familiarity of one adult stage for the uncertainty of the next. But the willingness to move through each passage is equivalent to the willingness to live abundantly. If we don't change, we don't grow. If we don't grow, we're not really living. Growth demands a temporary surrender of security. It may mean giving up familiar but limiting patterns, safe but unrewarding work, values that we no longer believe in, relationships that have lost their meaning. Though loved ones move in and out of our lives, the capacity to love remains. And for the mind freed of the constant strivings of the earlier years, there is time in the later years to ponder the mysteries of existence without all those interruptions. And we still have a lot of interruptions. Okay, maybe we can just glance back at this last section. First of all, the deadline decade from 35 to 45, when you realize that you're halfway over the hill and that you have to take a look at the other side. And then, is it true that after you get over there, there is a renewal or a resignation, one or the other? Anybody remember 35 to 45?
Probably a little bit of both. I think you go through a time, or at least I feel like I get a time of resignation and acceptance of just, okay, this is the way it is. But then being dissatisfied with that, trying and making an attempt to find some kind of renewal or new rejuvenation or whatever to make my life more interesting.
I think I'd agree.
Rather than one or the other, you could have both.
Yeah.
I think it started out as the other, and then you realize that you become stagnant and you do not grow. And so you get to the depression part of it. Is it worth it, all this struggle we've been through, or I've been through, or whatever? So there's got to be something more. And so you search for something that can rejuvenate.
Right at the end of the book, she tells one of her interview stories about a man who was a middle management type and then wanted to take over his mentor's job, and at about age 40 to 45, and it didn't work out. The boss didn't hire the best person around. At least he thought he was the best person around, and he didn't get the position. He was already hired by the company. And then eventually the company went through some tough times, and not only wasn't he the president or the vice president, whatever it was that he wanted to be, but he was laid off. And so this was a really rough time, and he decided that, listen, there wasn't anything he couldn't do, and he took all their life savings, he was married, took all their life savings and bought a brokerage firm. And then he didn't do very well with that, and they lost all of their life savings. And so he was finally said, look, I'm really not going to have everything. You know, he, for a while there, he was just, I climbed to the top, and if I, and when it didn't work out that way, he tried another way, and that didn't work out. And so finally he sort of was resigned to the fact that he wasn't going to be the person that he thought he was going to be. And his wife had stood by him through all this, and he went into first just a salesman in a brokerage firm, and then eventually he was appointed in charge of an office. And it was at a lower level than where he had been earlier in his life, but he was really happy. And even though it was a resignation kind of thing, he had to be resigned to where he was, he also was renewed in that he was satisfied with it. And he was willing to, he didn't think of it as a bad thing that had happened, but he ended up having more free time for his family, and he finally appreciated his wife who had been with him through all this. And it was kind of an interesting way, you know, it wasn't the greatest story in the whole book, but it kind of showed how you could have both of those.
He was an unusual man.
Yeah. Right. Yes.
I think this period between 35 and 45 is kind of, in a way, a replay of an earlier period where you're really searching for who you are, only this time mm-hmm. you're much more realistic.
Yeah. Yeah.
Finally you got your feet on the ground.
Yeah.
No, I haven't been through it, but I've seen some people go through it. And when you were talking about in the men, that, you know, this is the last chance to break from the pack and all that, I see that the old man once in a while, it's called the sailboat syndrome. He talks a lot about taking off from the sailboat and finding all kinds of new things. That doesn't sound very realistic, but it's a nice dream.
You and I live in a different slice of reality.
I think it wasn't until that age that I finally was able to drop shoulds in my life.
Okay, one thing that she says is that the ages are not so set for each person. You know, we kind of said, okay, 18 to 22. I think my one daughter has gone through a lot of that 18 to 22. I hope so. And then, but she says it's not so much that the ages are defined, but that the sequence of things, that they are going to happen in this sequence. And so if you've just now, what did you say? Let me tell you what's going to happen to you next.
Just now, I'm dropping the shoulds.
Dropping the shoulds. Okay, that was the 30s. Now, well, okay, now you'd be up to this realizing, you know, that you're halfway over the hill and then, you know, the 35 to 45 bracket. So you should go through all of these different processes according to Sheehy, if we agree with her, you know. You may say, no, I'm going to skip all that between 35 and 45, and I'm just going to go on with the resignation and say, that's it, friends. And, you know, she says you can't. Well, maybe if resignation is what you choose. She says you couldn't have renewal without going through some of the crises of the 35 to 45. Sometimes I don't agree with all that part of it either, that you have to have, you know, you brought that up before, you have to have this thing and you have to have that. I think, well, she says, of course, the opposite. If you don't have it, then you have, you know, a permanent home that you sit in and you don't grow. I was going to say my parents didn't seem to go through those kinds of crises, but they do sit in kind of a permanent position. Do you agree with me on that?
I don't know. I haven't thought about it enough. Mm-hmm.
I don't know, from my own experience, watching my parents, though, what I see of them is mostly stability, mm-hmm. and yet I know that there's undercurrent,
mm-hmm.
you know, things that are happening to them.
Mm-hmm. That they don't, you know, display that openly or
they're wise
discuss. They're Scandinavians.
They're wise parents not to let her see the undercurrents, perhaps.
Mm-hmm.
And yet that she is aware that they are happening.
They're there. Mm-hmm.
But it isn't disturbing to her. I think that through 45 and past, or maybe even a little before 45 and for about 5-6 years, I had the groping kind of feeling that I was going to live and die and never have lived. And it, and I felt sort of locked into it, but I didn't know how to solve it. And then we got into where my kids were old enough that my husband and I were finding this really enjoying each other much more, and it was just really kind of a special time then for 2-3 years, and then he was killed last year, so I don't know what would happen.
Mm-hmm.
Now I'm thrust into her position. Who am I, and what am I going to do with me? And,
I think kids probably force you through some things in that, you know, my parents have been forced through some changes that they probably wouldn't have, you know, wouldn't easily have, like, you know, as far as giving up the shoulds, you know, I think through us they're forced to keep growing, you know, giving up the idea that it's, you know, that it's bad to be divorced when their oldest son, you know, has to be divorced and find out that, you know, that was the best thing for that situation when all their life, you know, that was the thing to avoid,
mm-hmm.
you know, in different things.
Yeah, my parents were here for the last week and left yesterday, and I like to look at them and think that I've helped them to grow, you know. And some discussions that we had while we were here in the village. I, in fact, one day, my mother and I had a discussion on sex, which we never talked about before. I can't believe it, you know. But in like manner, I think I've learned a great deal from my kids. Stuff that I would have closed my mind on, stuff that I'm still not willing to admit in the same room that I might accept or not accept. But, you know, I have listened to them. And I have grown.
That might be a stage that, or that might be something that if you were, you know, if you happen to be a single person or not have kids, that you would, I mean, that their kids are something, sort of a catalytic agent for maybe some of those later, for some of those things to happen. You know, I don't know if anything would take the place of your children enforcing mm-hmm. that kind of development or not.
Yeah, maybe if you had some younger, you know, this mentor type relationship that might take the place of it. And I guess another thing I found out, another trap you can fall into, and I'm not trying to say this, Michael, to counterbalance, but I do learn a lot from my kids. But just today I found out something that one of them said that wasn't true, and I had not, it wasn't a lie. I don't mean that it was a lie, I just meant that it's something that was said as a fact that person believed. And it wasn't true, and I thought, gosh, I didn't think that they could make a mistake like that. But so I get myself in a corner here that I can't get out of. But but you know, just being the younger generation, I can take that between my mother and me too. I like to think that I know a lot more than she does, but I think I probably do, but I'm not always right, and. So if I think I'm teaching her things, I may be teaching her some things that are wrong. You know. Take it back, Mother. Okay, I think
so
we probably
may be teaching you some things that are wrong.
Well, or
they may think
that they're right, and I may think that they're right, and then later on we may all find out that we didn't agree with that. But I guess that's growing too.
Mm-hmm.
How much of this is culturally Americanized growing?
Yeah,
not like
that's
the rest of the world.
That's another thing that's non-scientific about Gail Shee. It's not a very scientific effort at all. The real scientific work hasn't been done. But I think she does have a lot of truth there. She can't prove it. And the separating out the cultural dimension, no way to do it from her data.
Do you think that the truth that you find in what she says would apply to most every culture? Or are you
I don't think so. I would be surprised if it did.
Yeah.
I don't even think that some of the things she's saying would apply to some segments of our society.
Oh, no.
She specifies
the very poor,
middle class. Yeah.
middle class and largely lumped up in the middle-aged group.
Almost sounds like middle-aged white Protestant.
And she said, it does pretty much. She said that she tried to very hard to include blacks and other nationality types, all kinds of things like that. She tried to make an effort on that. But the biggest effort was to keep it middle class. And if you keep it middle class, you're going to end up with more...
You have homogenized Americana.
You're still having the American Cultural Society.
Right. Even if you get some blacks, they're likely going to be the ones who have...
The white blacks.
Become acculturated to... Mm-hmm. Right.
But then, when you remember who she's trying to sell her book to...
Right.
Oh, come on now.
Okay. Those of you, most of you, I'm sure all of you know by now, this is my husband, since I've been doing that all the time. But I wanted him particularly to react to this too, and I didn't say that earlier on the tape, because he is a clinical psychologist and deals with people and their problems and their ages and stages and everything all the way along. And since I'm going to produce some kind of a paper out of this whole thing, I thought this is one time when I'd have him as a captive audience, and I would get his words on the tape too. So
she not only got all you on tape, she got me on tape. Real prize.
Okay, thank you for helping me. I won't send you a copy of my paper, but thank you.